under threat of invasion. So that means every listener that's in the South African region or in any Pan-African nation, Congo or Kenya or anywhere, that way, Sudan, doesn't matter. The influences are coming from the Zionist Jewish cabal, the banking cabal, from the American government, which works for that cabal, and the British government. And now, of course, the French have joined in full force and put their efforts behind this enterprise as well. So what we need to do, ladies and gentlemen, is start understanding the depth of this conspiracy, the crimes that are being committed, and how we might best save ourselves and save the world and for our children. You know, I've always worried personally about how my grandchildren are going to grow up and what kind of world they're going to have. I mean, my sons are already grown and they have a life for themselves. But and of course, they're being grown men, and they have a knowledge of the world, limited as it is because of their age. They have a knowledge of the world that is going to hopefully bring quality experiences to their lives. With the world turning so negative, so troubled, so violent, so desperate for food, for homelessness rising, pornography rising, school problems arising, terrible education systems are coming to be the norm rather than the exception. These kinds of things don't bode well for my grandchildren, nor do they bode well for the future of humanity, regardless of where you are listening to this broadcast from. And when you look under the surface of these problems that we have, you can see the group that brought them to us is the same Zionist criminal group, whether it be genetically modified food, which is poisoning us, or the drug industry, which is robbing us of our money and then poisoning us with their drugs. And sadly, many physicians in this world sign on to this these sickening concoctions and potions, thinking that these are going to solve the problems of health for people, when in fact, and more often than not, they complicate people's lives. What we really should be doing is educating people on how to eat better, how to preserve the healthful environment of their lives. In other words, how it is that non-genetically modified foods, not cooked in a destructive way, such as cooking out the vitamins and so forth, not pasteurizing a good milk that would allow us to have a good flora, a good bacteria in our stomachs, not destroying and adulterating our meats and our other foods with hormones, which is what the American market does, and many others today. Vaccines that are coming online from people who are now, we've seen vaccines with live virus, live bird flu in them going around. In other words, this group that we are up against, and trust me on this, the research does show that it's the same people behind the banking structure as are behind the other problems I just mentioned, are going to destroy the future for our grandkids. And to me, it's unacceptable. I won't allow that to be the future for the people I love, and I'm going to do everything in my power to stop them. And I believe that should be educating, because if this word grows, if these truths grow, if these research facts become better known, these people cannot live behind their lies. We are shining a light on their crimes. That is what I hope to do in tonight's broadcast. It is what I hope to do with every broadcast. Your job as listeners is to share this information with your fellows, with your colleagues, with your parish, with your mosque, with your friends, your neighbors. Tell them to listen in. Tell them to share this information. Tell them all to re-research. Look into the claims I make again, just to verify for themselves that I have been honest about my research and I have been honest about my claims. And what you will find, ladies and gentlemen, is you will find many people are becoming willing to hear these facts. They are watching the things that I predicted happen all around them. They are aware that the future future for their children and grandchildren is slipping away from them. Their culture being destroyed. Their morals being destroyed. Their community, sense of community being destroyed. You can see this, ladies and gentlemen, in both Christianity and Islam today. And oddly, we would expect the governments of our countries to support us against these people, and yet, in every instance, with no exception that I can think of, are we seeing support from governments against these criminals. They have a very long reach, ladies and gentlemen. Many people are very, very afraid of standing up against these people, but what is our option, really? What is it that your legacy going to be if you stay silent, if you stick your head in the sand facing these issues? You know, I read on the front of the CII website that a child was recently trampled in a food handout situation where they were giving out food to people who were poverty-stricken and needed aid for food, and children were injured and one killed, and others severely injured, in fact, maybe more deaths than just the one. This is a harbinger or a snapshot of what I believe is going to become commonplace in many parts of the world, and frankly has already begun in many parts of the world. I do want to bring up an issue that I have been talking about on my on other broadcasts I do about Ireland. The Irish economy is failing miserably, ladies and gentlemen, and Ireland, if you know anything about their history, has been a victim of this crime gang for centuries, as we have all been, but especially the Irish. And the present leadership in Ireland and the political parties in Ireland have been signed up to this crime gang, in my view, for some time. Their banks are controlled out of London. Their political structure and their opposition are controlled. And I had an experience this past week with one of the parties in Ireland that I find their leadership to be very suspect and should be examined again by the listenership to bring out more information on these facts. But the Sinn Féin, which was supposed to be the resistance movement against Britain, seems to have sold out in some way. I mentioned a group in a phone call. I was supposed to have one of the people from Sinn Féin on this evening, and I decided, and it was me that decided, not to bring on this person after I was hung up on for mentioning the word common purpose. Common purpose is the new Freemason movement of the world generated by Zionist Jews. And if you look into a woman named Julia Middleton, who used to be a communist leader in the Communist Party of Great Britain, who some years ago was mysteriously received millions of dollars to start a charity called Common Purpose. They are the same people pushing the lying agenda of global warming and of carbon taxing and of a resource limitation on people who own property, property rights destruction. But more than that, they're finding their way into government structures worldwide, and they are a fifth column in the world. They're in France, they're in Ireland, they're in Britain, they're in Canada, America, and I would guess South Africa as well. So when I brought up the name Common Purpose, I was immediately hung up on by a high-level person within Sinn Féin's Dublin office, and that was a very telling experience for me. And what it means to me is that this whole group needs to be more thoroughly investigated. It's clear that they never have told the truth on issues such as 9/11 or any other issues over the last 8 years. And they have not saved Ireland in any sense, in any way, from any of the problems that are being foisted upon that small nation as we speak. So I needed to get that out. So, ladies and gentlemen, after the break, we're going to come back with my two guests, James Thring and Mohammed Rafiq, right after this.
CII, the world is listening. Are you?
The French Connection with Daryl Bradford Smith.
Back, ladies and gentlemen. It's great to be back with you all. You know, my two guests coming up, I'm going to bring up the first one here as I have him already on hold. And, we have them both. This is really great. Great job to my engineers. I want to take a moment here and thank CII for their courage. You have to know, the listening audience has to know, that this radio station deserves your full support. They have been fearless in their support for my research and for the work that the French Connection has done. And they have done an honorable job in every sense at presenting my side of the things when they were being threatened. The South African Board of Jewish Deputies, or I think that's the name of it. But anyway, they were being attacked, and the radio station did everything in their power to keep me informed of it and make sure that I stayed on air, and I have to be grateful for that. And so give them your support. One other thing, I want everyone to know that I am I am not a for-profit group. I don't have advertising on my site, nor do I receive sums of money that are enough to keep me supported here on the French Connection. And if anybody out there has the ability to help me stay in business, they should forward their support to maybe the radio station or other places for me to receive it, because I am definitely feeling the bite over here. My life is getting very, very thin on my end, as everyone's is going to be if they are in a modern world today. You know, this is a bad time to be solvent money-wise. But anyway, I'm going to bring up my guest right now. Dr. Thring, are you with me?
Yes, I'm here.
And Mohammed Rafiq, are you with me?
Yes, I am indeed. Good evening, Darrell.
Nice to have you back, Mohammed, and Dr. Thring. You know, I was talking with Dr. Thring, James, earlier about a book that he read that really got a fire lit under him regarding the Rothschilds during World War II.
Right.
And I'm going to let him open up with a few of the things that he discovered in that book and how it affected him, because from what I understood from our conversation, it set him on a research track that has led him to where he is today, speaking to us in this forum. And I will let Dr. Thring know that Mohammed Rafiq and I both have a great deal of knowledge of this subject as well. So, Dr. Thring, why don't you tell us all a little bit about what you read in that book and what it meant to you?
Well, sure. It was a book written by Roland Perry called The Fifth Man in about 1996. And he uncovered from the files of the ex-KGB that Victor Rothschild, Lord Victor Rothschild, had been secretly funneling British secrets about nuclear weapons and about radar and other equipment to the Russians during the and after the Second World War. In other words, he'd been showing his allegiance to Russia, which was, of course, to do with protecting the Jewish people of Germany by pitching Russia against Germany, when most of the British establishment was suspicious of Russia because it was threatening to take over Europe.
Was that the time? Now, see, we're doing this in hindsight. At the time, was that considered an act of treason?
Well, technically, it's not treason, because that envisages the death of the monarch. But I believe it could certainly be called treason in general parlance, yes.
Well, now here's the interesting thing. We also had people after the war, in the 40s and 50s, people like Armand Hammer,
yeah,
also from the Jewish community, ferrying very important information from Washington and from New York over to Russia to supply them with computer information, how to build defense systems and the like. So this seems to have been a Zionist idea that they could export the good ideas, military ideas, from the United States and Britain to Russia rather freely.
Yes, that's right.
And what else did Victor Rothschild have, involvement did he have in this?
Well, his main involvement was by becoming, first of all, a technician with MI6 and MI5, the military intelligence agencies, and then rising to the position where he could teach them scientific details. So he managed to get the details of our research by saying, I'll take this home and think about it overnight, and I'll bring it back tomorrow morning and with an improvement. And during that time, he would fax all not email, of course, but send the details to his contact in the KGB.
Hmm. Well, there are no surprises there because we find this kind of double dealing throughout history. Mohammed, are you familiar with this case of Victor Rothschild?
Not the specific details, but I am generally with the idea behind the fifth man, and I am aware that members of that family have. He's not the only one to have made their way into the intelligence services and understand the import of having high and key positions in the intelligence services. But for one of them to have actually been named in a book doesn't surprise me in the slightest.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, we also know that when the Cold War took shape, that in advance of that Cold War, we had the Malta meeting going on, and we had, of course, Roosevelt and Churchill and Stalin get together and actually divvy up Europe, Western Europe, I mean Eastern Europe. And what we do know is that there was very little fight given over Hungary and Czech and Slovakia and Poland and so forth. We victimized those populations and forced them into a horrendous life. Many people lived and died in complete tyranny. Mm-hmm. As a result of the decisions. Now, does this book have anything to say about that period as well?
Well, it goes on to say how from the war onwards, from Churchill onwards, Victor Rothschild was very instrumental in dictating or influencing British foreign policy, and particularly where Russia was concerned. So, and of course, the underlying trend of Rothschild's advice was to protect the Jewish people and provide them with a homeland in Palestine.
Right.
So wherever there were Jews, like in Romania, Czechoslovakia, Poland, and so on, he took an interest in making sure that the Russians didn't stop them going out, and of course that the Germans didn't kill them on the way. So he has that influence, and it's beautifully clearly spelled out by the book. As I say, he had a hand over Churchill because Churchill became rather poor as a result of his property dealings, and Victor Rothschild helped him out.
Ah, now it's interesting to note that many of the lords in Britain, including Lord Mountbatten, were from the Jewish community, and there are many others that have bought their way into peerages and the rest over a period of a few hundred years.
Yeah.
Were there other allies that Victor Rothschild found within the British establishment to help him in his double dealings?
Well, there were. There was Bevan, who was again instrumental in helping to establish the Jewish state. There were other people like Sir Zolly Zuckerman in the scientific community who were again helping with scientific equipment and knowledge, which they also shipped to Israel. You have to remember that Rothschild was also in league with the Mossad, so he was acting as a double agent there as well.
Yeah. Well, the foundation of Israel. I'll bring this question over to Mohammed. The founding of Israel in just after the war was a bloody affair. And what we do know is that the British were trying to keep the peace, and they were trying to, in some way, and it seems in some way, honor at least in some small part the original agreement of that Palestine would have some say over its land and some say over Jerusalem and so forth.
Yeah.
But what we found is in places like Jenin and other places, the Zionists just wholesale murdered these Palestinians with just abandon. I mean, they frightened many of these people out of their homes by being so brutal. And yet after hundreds of British were murdered at the King David Hotel by the Irgun, there didn't seem to be any retribution for this.
No, it's odd, isn't it? The Rothschild was instrumental in setting up Haganah, which was the equivalent of the intelligence agency, a forerunner of Mossad. And that, of course, was, being his baby, was protected from any kind of retribution by the British authorities, I believe.
Do you think it's because the people in Britain who put their head up above the parapet were either ruined financially, like maybe Churchill was, or even outright killed?
Yes, I think there were certainly letter bombs sent to quite a few British people in the administration, as well as politicians, by the Zionists, Ergun and Haganah. So it wouldn't have been Rothschild himself directly, but indirectly we can see that there's a potential link there.
Yeah. Well, Mohammed, I want to go to you on this next question here. You know, when this was all taking place in the 40s and moving into the 50s, this is when they were trying to consolidate their power in the United States, and they ran up against some resistance, of course. And you had the McCarthy period, and you saw that McCarthy's efforts were completely washed out by mistakes he made in associations, you know. And I have had experiences with making bad associations, so I know how that can happen. What was happening in the world that gave these people the ability to do this? I mean, they were moving with impunity in France, in Britain, in Australia, and in the United States, and of course through Brofman in Canada. This is when they were building their arsenal of control. I mean, it looks like the 50s and 60s was the time they were really making their move.
Well, it certainly was a very important time for them, in that at that stage in history, they still had to act in a covert fashion. When you examine the position of being a double agent, someone who behaves treasonously and as a traitor, which are two terms which are easily applicable. Most of the other people, one assumes, in the intelligence services weren't aware that Victor Rothschild was the fifth man. And, of course, that what they would have seen is a man who had been placed in a position of enormous trust and responsibility, and that everyone would be assuming that he would be, shall we say, beyond reproach. Because usually people who get into that kind of a position for a country are batting for that country and looking after the country's best interests. Of course, that means that if he said, I started Haganah, and although it looks Israeli in shape, it's really an extension of British intelligence, of course British intelligence are going to leave it alone, because one of their higher echelons is actually saying it's part of their own operation. Hmm. And it strikes me that they examined the structure of society in different parts of the world and looked for these kind of key positions and used their favours, fears and bribes to get into those key roles. And that's what was happening in the 50s, 60s and before then. They were targeting areas of society that they realised put them, shall we say, almost beyond reproach, Darrell, and then trying to get into those positions so that they could use their influence without being overt. Because obviously just we have the situation in the United States today where there are so many members of the U.S. administration who are openly dual passport holders.
Mm. That's right.
One would assume that would be completely untenable as a position for somebody in the intelligence services. Their job is to look after national security. Mm. And the idea that they could have a second allegiance is exactly what the internal vetting procedure is supposed to be making sure doesn't arise. This is something that should be vetted out during the procedure, where the dual loyalty is there. And clearly these people had very strong loyalties to what was basically another state.
Hmm. Well, look back at that period when we had Egypt erupting. Of course, with the influence of communist Russia, led by primarily and principally by powerful Jewish interests, working with Egypt. Of course, we had the Suez War, which Britain was involved in many ways, and of course the French got involved in. We had Lebanon in that period in the 50s with the Americans' involvement. And then we had, of course, Mossadegh getting overthrown. We had the Ba'ath Party grow, given birth to. And of course, we know that people like Saddam in his early years was one of the first people put in place under the, Nasser and the rest. I mean, what I'm saying to you is that that period of history was a rejig. They were refixing the map in the area around Israel, and it seems to me they were doing it to fit that Knesset map of the greater Israel, because if you look back at the 50s and 60s, it seems like all of those political events and wars that were being started were all about fulfilling that larger role, which is what the end game today looks like. We're finally at the place where they want to be, which is a greater Israel under their control. And do you have anything to say about that, James?
Well, yes, I've been quite heavily involved with Iraq, and also I was originally informed by Kitty Little before she died that Iraq would one day become a part of the part of Eretz Israel. And I didn't really believe her at the time. This was in the 80s. But now it's perfectly clear that the Israelis have moved in very heavily in the north with the Kurds,
yep,
and also with the rebel groups in other parts of the country. And, of course, they've been buying up property as well. And we don't know quite what's happening to the oil, but they've reinforced the pipeline to Haifa from the Tikrit field, so from the northern field in Iraq. So it's quite likely that scenario has come true, as you say.
Didn't they lay the groundwork for that in the 50s? I mean, because what I'm trying to do is bring people through the political events, because many of us weren't. I was born in the 50s, James. I wasn't really aware of all of these things in real time, and I'd like people to move historically into where we are today through history. And in the 50s, it seems like with the Suez question, they needed to consolidate and change the power structure in Egypt. And of course, they've had some hiccups in that one. Of course, with the but they were working the Levant affair. They had that kind of activity, the terrorist activity, the earliest stuff we had in of terrorism. My point is that this is just a continuation we have, and it's almost an end game right now. Is that fair to say?
Well, it certainly is, yes. I mean, if I could fill you in on the history as far as Iraq was concerned, the Ba'ath Party was formed in order to protect Jerusalem from Israeli incursion. And that sort of felt pull to Saddam Hussein to put into action, and that's why he was targeted, particularly by Mossad. Viktor Ostrovsky says in his book, The Other Side of Deception, that the higher echelons of Mossad were saying, Saddam Hussein is our greatest enemy, and we're going to use the American army to destroy the Iraqi army in the Iraqi desert before it arrives on the borders of Israel, because they were seriously believing that Iraq was going to take military action to thwart their expansion into the West Bank.
But I don't entirely go along with that, though, fully, because now let me tell you why. Maybe Mohammed has something to say about this. We do know that there were high-level communication going on with Saddam and the American government throughout the 80s, especially during the Iranian War.
Yes.
But even before that, and the CIA had helped him actually get himself ensconced in power,
yes,
even as far back as when he was just a low member in the Ba'ath Party over in Egypt. He started under Nasser, didn't he?
Yes.
So my point is that he was playing both sides, and it seems like he was taking his cue from Washington, which, of course, Washington was under the full control of Zionist Jews throughout the last 40 years. It seems like they've been playing the political chess with this region for a long time, knowing full well that the end game would be a greater Israel. And it seems like that's where we are.
Well, the answer to that conundrum is that the Jewish lobby in America didn't really mind whether Iraq was well-armed or not. so long as they had another enemy that they could unleash their arms against. And that was orchestrated by Henry Kissinger in the 80s when they started to fight Iran over a mythical problem in the Shatilana waterway. And that managed to destroy quite a bit of the armies on both sides.
Well, so now let's take a look again at Mr. Rothschild's involvement. When was his involvement ended? I mean, when did he finally step down? Because Victor Rothschild died in what year?
He died in 92, I think, shortly after the fall of Russia and the exposure of all this in the book. May have been 3.
92, 93? Yeah.
Might have been 93 or 4.
Now, was he still active in the intelligence community in the 70s, 80s, and into the 90s, or was he turn that over to someone else?
It officially came to an end, according to the book, in 1969. But I would imagine that he was still active in a sense, because he had a job with Shell as one of their envoys. And that would be easy to assume could be linked with gathering intelligence about what Arab countries producing oil were up to or thinking about in terms of their concern for what was happening to their Palestinian brothers.
Now, Mohammed, you have other information about the Rothschild clan in this last century that is pretty important as well. I mean, we've seen, and I'm going to go back to James in a minute on this, but I'll go to you, Mohammed. We've talked many times, years ago we started, about the Balfour signings, and everybody who knows anything today about this conspiracy knows about the Lord Balfour receiving, sending a letter to Mr. Rothschild talking about the quid pro quo for American involvement and then their ultimate turning over of Palestine. And we know that the Second World War was a way that they used to populate Palestine after the fact. You want to talk a little bit about some of those conspiracies and how we got to this? It's kind of backtracking a bit, but it's good to revisit it.
Well, of course, you look at the whole collapse of the Ottoman Caliphate, and you can see that there was a hidden agenda on behind that as part of the run-up to what became the First World War.
Yeah.
And you can't help but look at the history and realize that all of that was set up so as to put Britain in power so it could make that declaration. Although the Balfour Declaration came out fairly late on in the First World War, it was clearly part of the original agenda. And in fact, that you can see, for instance, when the Ottoman Caliph sent a deputy group to Britain after the initial declaration of war by the Allied forces against Germany. And the Turks were very worried about the fact that they were perceived as German allies in spite of having a strong relationship with the British during the time of empire. So they sent a deputy over to make a public statement, which was that during this forthcoming war against Germany, Turkey would remain neutral. So that was their official stance. And, of course, the delegation was sent back with a letter from the British Foreign Office stating that the British government does not accept your neutrality in the forthcoming war. So Britain had the option of not having any form of conflict in that part of the world. It was offered to them that the land would be neutral, but they wouldn't accept it. They effectively declared war on Turkey, which
didn't that lead up to the attack on Gallipoli, where the British troops were soundly defeated and a huge loss of life. It was an unsuccessful assault. What we saw there was the vaulting of a Zionist out of the Salonika Grand Orient Lodge named Ataturk, who happened to have Jewish roots. in his family as well as his background. And so what we saw here is, you know, the caliphate was infiltrated by Zionists. They were playing both sides of the fence. They had infiltrators in the caliphate. They had people infiltrated in Britain. They sent young British soldiers to their death in Gallipoli. And in fact, the whole thing was a setup. It's astonishing. But you see this over and over again. Is that a correct assessment?
Well, it certainly is, and that's why it's absolutely staggering but true to find key players behind the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia suddenly turning up in Turkey, helping with the fomenting of the revolution there.
And that would be Carasso, and what's the other one?
Well, there were quite a few.
But Carasso, and we also had Jabotinsky involved down there.
Jabotinsky was a major player in the Russian Revolution.
But he was also, he found his way into Turkey as well, didn't he?
That's right, and helping overthrow the caliphate there. And the thing again that you know that all the links of the Young Turk Revolution go straight back to the House of Rothschild. It's a historical fact. It's not a theory. It's not a conspiracy. It's a well-documented historical fact. And then we suddenly have this bizarre behaviour of, you know, why was Lawrence sent around the Arabian Peninsula, the Arabia Felix, in armoured cars full of boxes with gold coins and gold bars, which had arrived in Jeddah from an Admiralty warship that left Portsmouth, all from the Bank of England. Why was he going around buying off all of these Arab sheikhs? I mean, all of a sudden, from nowhere, comes the Balfour Declaration, and then the Grand March by General Allenby, leading 279,000 people into Palestine, a fait accompli. The rest of the First World War, there's a marvellous film now which sort of describes the war in the most bizarre way, Oh What a Lovely War, where the whole thing was just stretched on, and the various sides were allowed to just send troops to be slaughtered.